Good morning, and thank you for joining us. You're listening to Smart Talk. We're here every Saturday at 9 a.m. And today we're going to be talking about charter schools and vouchers, how each of them work and who's benefiting and who is losing out. If you have any questions, give us a call, or questions or comments, give us a call at 520-790-2040. So Arizona is sometimes called the Wild West of privatization. We are one of the first states to have charters. A plan way back when Governor Fife Symington and then Representative Lisa Graham Keegan came up with what they would consider their signature bill. And the bill allowed open enrollment, which would let children go to schools outside their district boundaries. It created school report cards and expanded preschool for at-risk children. And it established a new type of school, charter schools, which were designed to operate independently with fewer rules and very loose oversight than their district counterparts. We are now 30 years down the road and have another piece in the privatization pie, which is vouchers. Vouchers, sometimes called empowerment scholarship accounts or ESAs, take money from the state fund and use it for private schools. Again, if you have any questions or comments, call us at 520-790-2040. So our first guest is Karen Kirsch. She has more than 25 years of experience at public colleges and universities. She teaches and publishes on women's literature, poetics, and public discourse at Arizona State University. The mother of two school-aged children, and believes that the people of Arizona, not out-of-state billionaires, should make decisions about the shape of public education in our state. She is one of the six moms who co-founded Save Our Schools Arizona in 2017, and she now serves as the director of research. In the first year of their existence, Save Our Schools Arizona collected 111,540 signatures to stop voucher expansion, which is pretty impressive. So, hi, Sharon. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, how did SOS begin? What's the origin story for Save Our Schools Arizona?
Well, the origin story is really that the six of us who co-founded Save Our Schools Arizona kept running into each other at the legislature during the 2017 legislative session. And we all have kids and school-age kids, and we had kind of a general sense that our public schools were struggling in Arizona, but we didn't quite understand just how much. And then we watched this bill, this one bill, pop up at the beginning of the session, and we thought it had died. And suddenly at the end of the session, this bill to expand ESAs, empowerment scholarship accounts, universally so that all kids would have access to these vouchers, just sort of slipped through by one vote. And we were dumbfounded. We just thought, how in the world could the legislature let this happen and take more of these public funds out of our public schools when our public schools were facing such a crisis? And we didn't at the time have much political experience. We literally Googled, how do you refer a bill to the ballot? We knew that that was something our Constitution allows us to do in the state of Arizona. And that's when we decided to start the signature gathering campaign and see if we could get it on the ballot. And it became Prop 305. And was resoundingly defeated last fall by a 2-to-1 margin.
Although, again, in last session, it's as though the voters had not spoken because a number of voucher expansion bills were also proposed.
Yes.
And it's interesting that we have a legislature that seems, and this is the kindest way to put it, tone deaf to the will of the people.
Yeah. You know, the more that we've learned over the years we've been at this, we understand that people who want to privatize all of our public schools are very, very well funded, and they're very systematic and very incremental in what they do. So we knew that regardless of the fact that the citizens of Arizona made very, very clear they did not want any more vouchers, they tried last session to either introduce or have hearings on five different voucher bills. And so Save Our Schools was very, very busy making sure that none of those passed and making sure that all of those people who signed our petitions, all of those thousands and thousands of people we talked to who really support our public schools because, 95% of Arizona families send their kids to public schools, district schools, and charter schools. So we know, and that vote on Prop 305 just made so clear how much the citizens in our state support public education and want our legislature to listen to us and to do the same.
Why do you think this is such a disconnect between what Arizonans feel, which is huge support for public education, and who we're electing into office who do not support public education in the way we would like them to?
It's tricky, I think, because if you ask any legislature, do you support education, they will, of course, say yes.
Yes, yes.
So I think what we have learned is that people, just a short conversation with people to help them understand that it's important to support public education and not all these schemes that take all of these public dollars out of our public schools and into largely private schools. And there's very little accountability or tracking of that money. And so I do think people around the state have been interested in learning more, and they understand now how to ask better questions of the people who are representing them or running to represent them, and to make sure that they really are going to support public education. I think, unfortunately, what's happened in Arizona is, for the last 25 years, Arizona has been kind of a petri dish for trying out all these privatization schemes. And of course, the people who support these efforts to privatize our public schools, like the American Federation for Children, which is an organization supported by Betsy DeVos and her family, and the Americans for Prosperity and the Goldwater Institute, supported by, in part, Koch brothers' money, they're really a minority voice, but they are so well-funded that they have been driving education policy in our state for two decades, and really until we put the voucher expansion bill on the ballot, that was the first time that the brakes, anybody really threw the brakes on them in a big, big way.
So last year there was this article published in the Educational Researcher Journal. And what the researchers were looking at was, does attendance in private schools predict student outcomes at age 15? And this was a longitudinal study. It was a 15-year study in 10 states. And they found that the use of vouchers to attend private school yields zero academic gains for low-income voucher users. But wealthier students who use vouchers did make significant gains. In a state like Arizona, where we're quite poor and we're at the bottom of the barrel in per pupil spending, why would our policymakers want to divert what little money we have away from the public school, where, as you said, 95% of students attend, and put it into something that doesn't really have a body of research behind it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good question. I think the body of research is growing. And I think it is continuing to show that there really aren't substantial gains by students who use vouchers. And there are some studies that are done by organizations that support school choice and want privatization. And so their studies are quite biased. But they also have done some studies recently where the data just shows there really are not significant gains, especially for kids who are struggling. And so we see, like in Arizona, oftentimes the students who can take advantage of school choice are the students who have parents who, for example, can drive them across town to a charter school or can make up the difference in a private education tuition between the voucher they get from the state of Arizona and the remaining tuition. So not all students even have access to these programs. And even when they do, the data shows that students just don't do better. And that's across the board in other states as well that have vouchers.
So do you think that in Arizona, the move to privatization has more to do with an ideological view that the private sector can always do a better job? Or do you think it's, more of the for-profit method?
Right. I think actually it's both. I think the origins of vouchers in particular come from Milton Friedman. And he really believed that the market economy would drive competition in our schools and that that would help us have really great schools. And, you know, at Save Our Schools, we don't believe our kids should be turned into dollar signs, and that schools should be about profit. And unfortunately, what we have seen over the years is that these efforts to privatize schools have become, or to privatize education, has become extremely lucrative. And some people make a lot of money off of these. And so in Arizona, with our charter schools, we've seen that. There were stories in the news last spring about one of our legislators making millions of dollars selling his charter school chain. As you said earlier, our charter schools don't have to, they don't have to adhere to the same level of rules and scrutiny that our district public schools have to adhere to. And so it's really not a level playing field even between charter schools and public schools. And, you know, I guess if a charter school can't be accountable and transparent about how it's spending its money and how its parent company that may own it or the chain schools is spending its money, then it seems really clear that they're not working in the best interest of our kids, and they're paying more attention to the profits that they can make. And the people who suffer are our kids.
Exactly. And our state in the long run because of our kids suffering. Sharon, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and our guest today is the Sharon Kirsch, who's from Save Our Schools Arizona. We'll be right back. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and we are here every Saturday. And we hope you'll join us. Right now, I'm speaking with Sharon Kirsch. She is the one of the founders of Save Our Schools Arizona, and she now serves as the director of research. So I wanted to ask you one quick question, and then I wanted to talk to you about school tuition organizations. But the Grand Canyon Institute says that while vouchers are sold as a benefit to keep costs down, it actually costs more than our per pupil spending. So what is the cost of vouchers? Because that is how they're sold. You know, it's not going to cost the public schools anything if we do this.
Right. So one of the ways they come up with those numbers is they assume all the kids who are using vouchers or STOs, the STO vouchers, have come from a public school. But a lot of the kids who use those vouchers, so they say, oh, you're saving because you don't have to spend, you know, money on that kid. So you're saving that money. But what happens is the people who actually use those STO vouchers often are already at private schools. So it's not a savings to the public school. And it's the same with ESA vouchers. And I hope we can talk a little bit about how empowerment scholarship account vouchers are funded, because I think that's a little jaw-dropping for some people who aren't quite aware of how that works.
Well, why don't we talk about that before we get into the STOs?
Oh, sure. Okay.
And how they're funded, the ESAs slash vouchers. And also, I think the name is sometimes confusing because it has such a great name, empowerment scholarship accounts.
Yes, it sounds great. And in, for some kids, the ESA, the Empowerment Scholarship Account vouchers, are can be helpful. So when they started in Arizona, they were only for kids with special needs, and so special ed kids. And even at the beginning, so since then, so they started with just a small category of kids, and then it expanded to include...
Just to get the foot in the door.
Yeah, exactly. Then it's like kids on reservations. Then it's kids in foster homes. Then it's kids who are in DNF schools. Then it's the siblings of all those kids. And so there's that kind of incremental, little by little. So at first they said, oh, this is going to cost a lot of money. They said the same thing with STOs. The first year STOs came on, it was just $1 million. And now suddenly we spend almost $200 million a year on STOs. But with the ESA vouchers, the Empowerment Scholarship Account vouchers, they take public, our tax dollars, they load those tax dollars onto a debit card, and that's between $5,000 and $30,000 that they load onto a debit card, and they hand it to the parent. And there are limited, there are certain categories, things that a parent can spend that money on for their child's education. But it includes everything from tuition at a private school, which could be an autism academy, could be homeschooling, could be used to cover dolphin therapy, which we don't have anymore in Arizona. But there's very little.
Do you mean there are no dolphins here, or you can't go to a place with dolphins?
No, there are. I think we have no dolphins anymore for dolphin therapy.
Okay. Okay.
But those are the kinds of things that an ESA voucher can cover. So for each homeschooling family, we're buying, you know, we're buying certain educational products, and the next ESA homeschooling family spends the same money on those same, or spends more money on those same products. And so now we spend almost over $80 million a year on ESA vouchers. And there's been documented fraud. The Department of Education in Arizona oversees, administers these vouchers, but the legislature, which is supposed to provide up to 5% of the money that goes to vouchers to the Department of Ed to administer them, they have never provided that full amount. And so the Department of Ed is just inundated because the program has grown so much. And they are inundated with trying to administer this program without enough staff to do it effectively, which makes it very, very difficult for the families.
And that seems to be a consistent theme in Arizona, is that we don't have oversight on many of these alternative ways to spend education money.
That's very true. We do not. We really don't have a good sense of where that money goes, what the kids are learning in particular. That's very much the case with STOs. We don't know. We know that 93% of kids who receive STO vouchers go to religious schools. We just don't know what's happening with them in those schools. We know very, very little about that.
So it seems, if you could address, there seems to be two problems. One is we don't know where the schools go, I mean, where the children go, and what kind of education those schools are offering. But what about the businesses that collect the money, the school tuition organizations? And these are the organizations that collect tax credits for private schools, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes. So, in the example of the Empowerment Scholarship voucher, that's tax dollars that go onto a debit card given to a family. For STOs, it's a tax credit. So, for example, if I don't want my state taxes to go to the general fund in Arizona, I can give it to a school tuition organization, which many, many people do. Individuals can do that, and corporations can do that. And the school tuition organizations, it's really become a kind of cottage industry because they can keep 10%. So even though the Department of Education gets barely 2% to administer a much more complicated program, the people running these school tuition organizations get 10% off the top. And so, for example, the former president of our Senate, Stephen Yarbrough, who was instrumental in passing some of the laws that created school tuition organizations, he runs, and his family runs, the second largest STO in the state. And there was an article in the New York Times a couple of years back on this. He paid himself, I think, $150,000 a year. He outsourced the data. They had so many people donating or giving their tax credits to his Arizona Christian School Tuition Organization is the name of his. So he had to outsource the data to keep kind of track of all the money that was going in and coming out. He outsourced it to a company run by his wife, paid her a very healthy salary. They had car allowances. They rented office space in a building they owned, so they paid rent to themselves. So it's extremely lucrative to run a school tuition organization.
Yes, and he had an unusual thing. He rented to himself, but he also, for his own STO, but there was also another STO in that same office that they rented to at like a tenth of the cost. Mm-hmm. He was charging himself more, which is a good way to shift funds.
Yeah, and it's stuff like that to me, you know, that's just not good for our kids. Like, even if we were to say that STO vouchers were okay, like, it's not okay for somebody to be making that much money off of the state, off of taxpayer dollars that could be going to the general fund and helping fund our public classrooms where our teachers are buying their own supplies, asking parents to bring boxes of tissue. Like, it's just crazy to me. Our priorities are messed up, I think, and we need to really, really ask our legislators to prioritize public education.
And so in this next year, the year we're in, and the, you know, in 2020, what's next for Save Our Schools? Where are your priorities going to be?
So we are doing really what we've always done, and that is just talk to people. When we started circulating those petitions in 2017, literally everybody we told that we were going to do this and try to get this bill on the ballot, everybody said, oh my gosh, you can't do that. No volunteer group has ever done anything like that. You're going to fail. And we thought, okay, we're going to do it anyway. But even if we aren't successful, just talking to people and helping people understand and come to the same kind of understanding that we came to about just how serious the crisis facing our public schools is, we thought that alone would be a win. And so from day one, we have been talking to people, and we find over and over again that regardless of political party, Republican, Independent, Democrat, the vast majority of people in our state support public schools. They understand that not only will having strong public schools create an educated workforce, which is good for our businesses, but it keeps our property values high, and it's just going to make our state strong. So Save Our Schools Arizona has been, for the past few months, doing road shows, we call them, and we will present to a group of five people, a group of 150 people, and we have lots of information that we've tried. It's complicated how all this works, and so we've tried to take all this complicated information and help people understand what's going on and what they can do about it. And so we hope people will check out SaveOurSchoolsArizona.org, and if you're interested in learning more, we're always happy to come to any group and present.
Okay. Well, Sharon, I want to thank you for coming on the show and giving us your Saturday morning. And I also want to remind people they can find out more information at SaveOurSchoolsArizona.org. And are there any road shows that are going to be in Southern Arizona coming up?
You know, we will have one in Yuma. We had one 2 weeks ago in Tucson. We may have another one coming up. When the dates are set, we will put them on our website.
Perfect.
And people can check there.
Okay. Thank you again for coming on and for doing the remarkable work you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. And we will be right back after the break. We'll be joined by Jim Hall, the founder of Arizonans for Charter School Accountability. Thank you. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to Smart Talk. We are here every Saturday morning, and I am your host, Robin Hiller. And our next guest, oh, if you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 520-790-2040. Our next guest is Jim Hall. He is a fourth generation Phoenician and was a principal in Arizona for 23 years, serving in the Fowler, McNary, and Washington Elementary School Districts. He was mentored by David Berliner and Gene Glass while in a PhD program at ASU, where he focused on charter finances. After retiring, he founded Arizonans for Charter School Accountability in July 2017. And I want to ask him about the next part after being harassed at a charter board meeting. He has also worked to expose the waste, fraud, and corruption that plagues many Arizona charter schools by collecting and analyzing the spending data. This is data that the state charter board ignores. He has also filed over 150 formal complaints with state agencies. So, Jim, I want to thank you for coming in or calling in and talking to us about what you do. And one of the questions I wanted to ask first is, you had said that you started Arizonans for Charter School Accountability after being harassed at a charter board meeting.
Oh, hi, Robin, and it's great to be here. My nephew went to a charter school, and I was taking him every day. And it was a school that was only in session 4 days a week, and he stayed till about noon every day and was getting credits every 10 minutes. So, you know, I found that interesting. So I went to the board meeting.
Every high schooler's
school.
Dream.
Yes, it is. And so I went to the school board meeting of the charter school. It was a Leona school, is American charter school foundation is the name of. They have 10 schools here in Phoenix, and they have 9 in Phoenix and 1 in Tucson. And when I showed up, I don't think anyone had ever gone to one of their board meetings. I don't think they'd ever had an outsider at a board meeting. So they demanded my name, and I refused to give it to them. I just said I was a concerned citizen. And anyway, they demanded my name several times. And when I left, one of the executives took my picture on her phone and told me that she wanted to have that in case there were any problems in the future. So that upset me. And the next week, I got an LLC, and I formed Arizona for Charter School Accountability.
Wow. So why let's talk about how charters are overseen. It seems to an outsider as though there's very little oversight. And one of the things that is a big gap is that in a school, a district school, you have an elected school board. So if there's a problem, there's kind of a path to where you can go. You can go to the principal and then the superintendent and then the school board. But in charter schools, there seem to be boards, but they don't function in the same way as an elected school board.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, that's probably one of the main problems with charter schools here in Arizona. Public school boards have three pages of laws and state statute about how they operate and what their role is. Arizona charter schools have one single sentence, and it says that the charter school board will be responsible for setting the policies of the school. And that means that the charter school board that's at the charter, first of all, it can be appointed by the owner. It can be just the owner and his wife. Eddie Farnsworth had a one-man board where he was the only person on the board at his Benjamin Franklin schools. And so they can have anybody they want on this particular board, but the board doesn't do anything. All they do is approve policies like the parent, the visitor policy, or the internet usage policy, that sort of thing. They have no responsibility to hire or fire. They have no responsibility to approve expenditures, even things like student discipline or curriculum. They don't have to make those decisions at all. So with that in mind, there's no place to go for a parent if they have a concern with a charter school, because the real action in a charter school takes place at the corporate board. And so charter schools all have a corporate board, whether they're for-profit or non-profit, and that corporate board makes all those decisions. It hires and fires people. It decides the things to buy. It sets the curriculum. And those charter corporate board meetings aren't privy to open meeting laws or a public record request.
Why aren't they required to follow open meeting laws?
Because they're private corporations.
Even though they are publicly funded with taxpayer dollars.
That's right. And so even though the school board meeting is an open meeting, that nothing happens there, places like Great Hearts will have a meeting for all 23 of their schools, and the meeting takes place in about 10 minutes. They just approve the minutes from the previous meeting. They approve a policy, and then they go on. So that part is public. But what happens at the corporate level, that's a private corporation, just like APS or just like Ford Motor Company. And what goes on in their board meetings isn't open to the public, and that's a huge concern.
Are there charter schools that operate with a more transparent system with their board and with their finances?
Yeah, there are, and there's some really good charter schools. And you know, my intent isn't to get rid of charter schools. That's not a practical goal for us, but. Arizona School for the Arts is here in the Valley, and they do a great job. They have a very involved board. They make all their decisions in public, in the public meeting. They have their board has subcommittees that study things. When they build a school, they have a subcommittee that looks into it, and all that's done in public meetings. So there's charter schools that do the right thing. It's more work to do the right thing, you know, obviously, And there's charter schools that do that. But by state statute, they don't have to. And so the vast majority, you know, don't do that. There's charter schools that never have board meetings, even though they're supposed to. And we file complaints about that. But the law basically allows them not to have school boards that serve any meaningful purpose. But you're right. There's some charter schools that do a good job. And, you know, we commend them.
One of the things, you had done this report, and one of the things you point out is that charter state revenue has increased $645 per pupil since 2008, from 2008 to 2018, while district state revenue has declined by $718.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What happened in 2008 was, and it's been in the news and the subject of lawsuits, is the legislature took the capital money away from public districts. I know that when I was a principal in the Washington district, I had a capital budget of about $45,000 that I could use to buy computers and furniture and materials. The following year, it went down to $15,000. And I think now it's about 12 at the school I was at. So they cut all the capital funding, and it really hasn't returned. Ducey has done with increasing teacher salaries, and you know that's gone to teachers, but we still have a huge deficit in capital. And because they cut the capital revenue, that meant the teachers didn't get raises, you know, because they had to shift money away from money that could have gone to teachers to repairing roofs and repairing buses and doing minimal computer and textbook purchases. And that's why we have such a deficit with teachers. And charter schools, on the other hand, they get an additional $1,700 to $2,000 per pupil every year from the state, and that's because they can't have bonds and overrides. So those additional funds they can use to buy materials and to build their buildings. Well, those funds have actually gone up by 21% since 2008. So charter schools basically have had an increase of 21% in their ability to buy capital items, and public districts have gone down 718. And that's why, you know, public districts have old buses and leaky roofs, and why charter schools have brand new buildings, because their funding has increased by, you know, significantly since 2008.
Well, since 2008, there's been about $1.5 billion cut out of the public school budget. And there have been these small replacements, but we're still down in Arizona about $1.1
billion.
So
yeah, I think,
is the money coming out of the same pot? So we're not only 50th in the nation, but we're also diverting funds into other schools that have no oversight?
Well, and that's something that people may not be aware of. Charter schools get all their money from the state funding. So that pot of money we have at the state that is used for public education, K-12, all their money comes from that pot. So charter schools in 2008 they got about $7,300 per pupil from the state. Public school district schools, on the other hand, only got about $3,900. And the reason for that is because public schools depend upon property tax. And so a public school that has is very wealthy, they don't get much state aid at all. They may get the vast majority of their money from property tax. A poor district that doesn't have a lot of assessed valuation, that doesn't have money coming in from property tax, they will get more state aid. But even the poorest districts here in Phoenix, only about 60% of their budget comes from the state. The rest of the money comes from property tax.
So if you live in a poor community, you're extra struggling.
But you're still not getting the amount of money that all charter schools get, and because charter schools get all their money from the state. So one of the reasons we're 50th in the nation is because we've been diverting money from public schools into charter schools. Every time a student goes to a charter school, instead of paying the local district $3,900 for that kid, suddenly the state is paying $7,300 for that child. And that increase is one of the reasons that we've had such deficits in spending, and one of the reasons we're so far behind. Every child that moves to a charter school, the state is paying significantly, you know, almost $4,000 more for that pupil to go to that charter school. And part of that $4,000 is to build him a brand new building. So they're leaving a building in a public district that was built through a bond issue that the voters approved, and they're moving to a charter school, and they're going to get extra money there, and they're going to build a brand new building, and that building's going to be owned by the charter owner, and it's not going to be owned by the state at all. So we're diverting funds, you know, from the.
We're going to take a break in a second, but I have a quick question for you. Sure. What are the demographics in the charter schools compared to in the district schools? Are they? Do we have the same ethnic balance?
Overall, no. It's not as bad as you might think. There's 46% of our charter kids are white. 54% are white, and I think it's closer to 46% in public districts. So there's fewer Hispanic and more white kids. A lot more Asian kids are in charter schools, but they're not. It's not a huge difference overall. But all the big schools that are in Phoenix and Tucson, Basis, Great Hearts, those places, they're significantly different in terms of their racial backgrounds and the number of special ed kids and that sort of thing. So the big schools that are coming in tend to have far fewer minorities and far fewer special ed kids.
We're going to take a break, but when we get back, I wanted to talk to you about the special ed funding and what's been going on with district public schools and what's been going on with charters in the funding of kids with special needs. So we're speaking with Jim Hall. We will be back in just a second at Smart Talk. Thank you. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. We're here every Saturday. I'm your host, Robin Hiller. And if you have any questions or comments, you can call us at 520-790-2040. We're speaking with Jim Hall, and Jim Hall is the founder of an organization called Arizonans for Charter School Accountability, which he started in July 2017. Jim, I want to ask you about, since we don't have oversight and we don't have procurement requirements, could we first talk about the difference between what districts have to do for procurement and what charters have to do for procurement when they're buying things, and why that might be a problem, or what kinds of problems it has caused?
Well, as a school principal in a district, you know, we have to get phone quotes for items we buy over a certain amount and get written bids. I think state law has almost 6 pages of rules and regulations regarding procurement. And we had a big scandal here in Phoenix with the Scottsdale School District because they had an issue with their architect. On the other hand, charter schools have absolutely no responsibility to follow any procurement laws at all. They can build their entire school for $8 to $15 million with no bids. They don't have to disclose, you know, who's doing it or who's making the purchases. So by law, charter schools aren't responsible for following any procurement regulations, and that means that we have no idea, you know, where the money is going. Some charter schools actually build the schools themselves, and then they lease them to themselves. So they'll build the school, they'll have the school, then they'll lease it back to themselves for an unknown amount of profit. And we have no idea, you know, what went on, because, again, all those decisions were made at a corporate level where we have no access, the public has no access. So that's a major concern, and there's absolutely no transparency at all in how schools spend their money in terms of procurement.
And jumping on your thing about the boards of the charter schools, not only do they not have elected boards, but the charter board is an appointed board. It's not under the Department of Education with an elected superintendent. It is an appointed board mostly by our governor and also by the charter groups.
No, the Arizona State Board for Charter Schools has oversight over charters. They're the ones that that approve charters, and they're the ones that have oversight over existing charters. And they're all appointed, except for Superintendent Hoffman, who has a seat on the board. They're all appointed by the governor. And there's a requirement that one person be an owner of a charter school. And then there's other requirements. One other person has to be a member of the public, another one a member of the business community. But the 11-person charter board has four people that are directly tied to the industry. 2 years ago, Basis had a representative on the board. This year, there's a representative from Great Hearts on the charter board. So they're always well represented by the industry, but they're all political appointees. And they're, you know, they have a firm allegiance to school choice, which is fine, but it also lends itself to sometimes turning the other eye when it comes to oversight.
Can you talk a little bit about, I know there've been a number of scandals in Phoenix last fall, and can you talk about some of those and also the kind of millions in profits that charter owners have been able to get?
Well, the situation I mentioned earlier where the owner builds the schools and leases them back themselves, that was done by Senator Eddie Farnsworth and his Benjamin Franklin schools here in the Valley. He had a private real estate company that built the schools, and then he leased the schools back to him, to himself for a number of years. When he decided he wanted to cash out, he turned his schools over to a nonprofit that he created, and that nonprofit got a loan and bought the schools from him, and he made $14 million on that transaction. Glenn Way at American Leadership Academy.
Hold on, before we get to Glenn Way. So he sells the schools basically to himself as a nonprofit, and then he gets the money that has been used to build the schools?
Yeah, that's right. He built the schools, and let's say he paid $6 million for a school to build it. He's been leasing it back to himself for a number of years, and we're not sure if that lease was the amount the mortgage cost him for to build a school, or if it had more money in it, if he was making profit off that. But then he sold the schools then at their appraised business value to a nonprofit that he created. He still has control of the schools, basically. He still has a company that runs the schools, but he's created a nonprofit, and that nonprofit bought the schools from Mr. Farnsworth at a premium. And so he got all his money back that he borrowed, and plus he made $14 million in profit off the sale. And okay. He still has control of the schools.
He got reelected after that.
Yes, ma'am, he did.
Okay, so you were going to talk about Glenn Way before I interrupted you.
Yeah, then Glenn Way is the owner of American Leadership Academy. He did exactly the same thing. He had a real estate company. In fact, he owns a company that builds charter schools that they're based in Utah. He has two partners, and they build schools all over the Southwest. And so his company built the schools. He leased them back to himself. And then, last year he formed a new nonprofit, and that nonprofit got a loan for $192 million, and they bought all the schools he had built, back from him, and he made $18 million on that transaction. It's all completely legal. State law says that everything that a charter owner buys, they own. And so even though it's been paid for by public funds, so we've been paying the mortgage on these schools all these years from public funds, and now he sold them for this additional cost. Now what happens is they have even higher costs for their facilities. Eddie Farnsworth, they're in the top 10 of all the charter schools in Arizona and how much they spend on their buildings, percentage of their income. So we're still paying that. So they made the $18 million for Way and $14 million for Farnsworth, but we're still paying the tab for that because we're paying for the high mortgages that result from the sale where they made all this money.
And so the mortgages are taken from taxpayer money, and what gets goes down in the charter schools that they have run is things like teacher pay and classroom textbooks and things like that?
The stipulation in all the bonds, these loans that they get to buy these schools, the stipulation is that the very first thing that gets paid is that mortgage. So they sign a contract that says that the money they get from the state, the first thing they will pay is the mortgage, and then everything else is the schools to use. So there's a group of schools owned by the Leona Group that sold their schools to their owner that made over $20 million back in 2007. Well, they're having to pay these high mortgages, but unfortunately, the schools have lost 25% of their population, of their enrollment since 2007, 2008. So now they have a lot fewer kids. Their income is a lot less, but they still have these very high mortgage payments. It's just like your mortgage at your house, and when you lose your job or you get a cut in pay, you still have to pay the mortgage. Well, we're in the same situation. So those Leona schools I just mentioned, they've lost their enrollment, but to pay the mortgages, they've had to decrease their spending in the classroom to among the lowest in the state. And they're alternative schools, and they're using more computers in the classroom now, and they're hiring far fewer teachers because they have to pay those mortgages first.
The other thing that's interesting to me is that online schools get the same amount of money as brick-and-mortar schools.
They get 95% of the amount a regular charter school gets.
Oh, 95%, even though they don't have any of the expenses like buildings or chairs, desks?
Even teachers, you know, the number of teachers in an online school, you know, you're not going to have a teacher for every 30 kids. You know, the teachers are on the phone, you know, talking with kids. So they have far, far fewer teachers and no buildings to support and none of the expenses that go with buildings, but yet they get the same amount of money. And that doesn't happen in other states. In other states, it's prorated based upon expenses. So it's a great money-making deal. And a number of the charter schools that are online, some of them only spend half of their state revenue every year on the school. The Pinnacle schools, I think there's four of them here in the Valley, and they're an online school. You know, every year they spend half of their budget. The other half goes straight to corporate profits. So if they made $8 million, $4 million of that money went into their pocket. And that happens with most of the online schools. They're huge profit-making machines, and they have no oversight at all. The Board of Education and the Charter Board, by law, were supposed to have oversight over them and create a report every year to give to the legislature. They never did that. They never created the report, and both the Department of Education and the Charter Board literally looked the other way when it comes to online schools. They're huge money-making businesses, and their achievement is very, very poor. You know, a lot of kids go online, and these are the kids that probably, you know, need encouragement and need a school setting, and they're sitting at home, you know, on the internet. Well, you can see how far a lot of kids get with that, and mm-hmm. very few kids.
And doesn't Primavera have the third lowest dropout rate in the state?
Oh, they probably have more than that. They have Primavera last year had 24,000 students. So 24,000 kids took a class there, but they only got paid for 6,000 full and part-time students there. And we have no statistics because the State Department and the Charter Board didn't create the mechanisms to follow them. So we have no idea how many kids were actually successful. We don't know how many kids, you know, were enrolled and dropped out. We have dropout numbers. You're right. Primavera has some of the highest dropout numbers in the state, but I'm not sure those are anywhere near accurate. You know, very few kids that sign up at Primavera, I think, actually get credit. And they get paid for them anyway. And so that's the problem with online schools.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for coming on and also urge people to check out Arizonans for Charter School Accountability. I know you have a Facebook page. Do you have a website?
It is. It's azcsa.org.
Okay, great. And thank you so much. There's 30 seconds left. Do you think we can have accountability? Do you think there's any way to pressure the legislature and the state to have accountability over charters?
No, okay. I don't. I think with a Republican legislature, that's going to be pretty much impossible.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim, for coming on. I appreciate it. And I appreciate all this research.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. We will be back next week. Al Bergeson will be here. I want to thank you for listening to Smart Talk, and we'll see you later.